Hello, welcome back to the New History Podcast. We're on episode 7. Today we're planning to talk about art history. We've got some great experts on the topic with us today. Mainly our special guest today is Annalisa.
Hello.
Hello. With me as always, we've got Lily.
Hey.
And returning again from a couple of recent podcasts, we've got James.
Hello.
All right, so
first of all, perhaps we should give Annalisa a chance to tell us why she's here. But Annalisa actually runs the Accessible Art History channel on YouTube and Instagram. And she's essentially a great person to go to talk about any type of art history. So can you tell us very quickly what your interaction is with art history and art in general, just for everyone out there that doesn't know about what you do?
Yeah, of course. So thanks for the great introduction, guys. My name is Annalisa, and I started Accessible Art History because I felt like the discipline can sometimes get a little, you know, gatekeepy. And so people who maybe haven't been trained in the discipline academically felt like they could be left out. And that's not what I wanted for the subject. So I break down artistic periods and pieces into digestible, easy to understand, fun ways to learn, and it's my passion. I discovered art history when I was 15 years old in high school, and I am now 29 and haven't stopped. I have a bachelor degree in the subject with a specialty in medieval art from the University of Washington, and I am currently in grad school to become a teacher so that I can professionally teach the subject as well. And I'm a super nerd about it, so if I start to run on, just let me know, because I will talk your ear off about pretty much all art history, except kind of past the Impressionist period. I get a little bored, so I don't venture too much into the modern era.
That's fair. I don't think, well, I mean, yeah. I'm sure there is someone out there very interested past the Impressionists, but essentially, Annalisa is the answer to Alex's issue with art, which is mostly the gatekeeping and the weirding things, particularly in modern art. There is a very funny story, which I'll just drop here just so everyone understands what Alex's issue is with art. We were in Oslo in a wonderful trip full of, well, art and history and whatnot. And one of the things that we visited was Vigeland Park, which is a huge, beautiful park full of sculptures from Vigeland. And if you don't know who Vigeland is, go to the internet and Google it and be careful, because it's quite explicit, it's quite graphic. He worked a lot with nudity and naked bodies and whatnot. And he was already pretty traumatized by then. But the best part was when we went to the other park, to Erkenberg Park, and there was a modern art installation distributed throughout the park. And there he found a lamp that took. Yeah. And that was
it. Like a street lamp. That was I thought I was going crazy. I thought there were just voices coming out of the air, but it was coming from this street lamp.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was interesting. Yeah. No. When we went there, I think the kind of art I was more interested in there was like the Viking ships. You know, that counts as art, right?
Yeah,
100%.
The older art is better.
That's my opinion. That.
I mean, it's three medievalists and one, you know, ancient Roman person. So I think we can happily say that. But
we're a little biased over here.
Yeah, exactly. But on that front, what we're actually talking about today is Greek and Roman art, particularly during the golden periods, which we have sort of decided that it's really 5th century Greece and mostly Athens. And in the Roman side of things, James has defined this as sort of the last few decades of the first century BC up until mid second century AD. Am I correct?
Yeah, about 180. So it's regarded from about 20. It's about kind of 27 BC. Though I like to kind of put it back to 31 BC after Actium, through to about 180 or AD 180. So after the death of Marcus Aurelius, who was the last of what's called the five good emperors. It's only in the last century or so where its whole period has kind of been considered like the golden age. The original terminology came from Edward Gibbons, who kind of termed the golden age as specifically the Antonine emperors, so from Trajan through to Marcus Aurelius, which effectively is the best part of the second century AD. But it's been expanded now to try and to cover mostly what's called the Pax Romana, so the Roman peace. Mm-hmm. Or I'm doing this in big inverted commas, the Roman peace, because there's so many wars and everything, and it's like, yeah, it's not really a peace, but it's what's termed it.
So could you very quickly, for people out there like Alex or just in general, give some context as to why these two periods, both the 5th century in Greece and particularly Athens, and the period you're just referring to in Roman history, are considered quote-unquote golden ages? Because obviously the term golden age itself usually has to do with artistic developments and whatnot, and we see this elsewhere in history, like in the Spanish golden age, which is essentially, you know, a very important period of Spanish history where, you know, culture is at its maximum. Not so much the rest of the empire, but culture was great. So why the 5th century in Greek history, and why the early sort of stages of the empire for Rome? What makes that so special?
Well, you kind of just pointed out there. The golden age of art is it's so interlinked with political at the time, imperialistic golden ages. You can't really have one after one without the other. For Greece, yeah, the golden age is normally seen around classical Greece, which is effectively for the most part the 5th century. And this is a time when Greece has had a lot of division, but there have been times when they've had to come together for the greater good as well. So this is the century where you've got the famous Persian Wars that kicked off at the beginning of the century. So you've got the Battle of Marathon, where they first attempted a campaign in Greece to take over primarily Athens. And then you had the Second Persian War, which was probably the most famous because it includes the Battle of Thermopylae with the so-called last stand of the 300 Spartans against a million Persians, which everyone, you know, which kind of gets debunked quite a bit. And it's at this war where Greece has kind of come together, and many states are actually having to work together, which is something almost unheard of, to beat back this greater evil, this common enemy of the Persians. It was after that Athens started to become the head of a league called the Delian League. And this was a league of states which Athens was kind of a chair of. So they were, this league was designed to try and be the first defense if Persia should come back and attack again. So they would put in a proportion of military manpower, but most importantly, they would also put in a portion of wealth into this league. And the reason it's called the Delian League is because the treasury was at Delos. Over the course of the century, this golden age very quickly becomes what you could start being called the golden age of Athens specifically, because Athens starts becoming very hegemonic. It starts becoming very greedy with the states, and because it's the top of this league, it starts really taking advantage and really exploiting a lot of powers, to the extent that if they're not able to pay a sudden drastic increase in this league income, then Athens will say, okay, fine, we're going to attack you, we're going to take away your government, and we're going to install our own garrison, and they'll effectively take you over. So what it is also this century where the Delian League starts becoming the Athenian Empire, unofficially an empire, but the Athenian Empire as it can be called. But all this wealth is suddenly started being centralized in Athens, and this is where you get the explosion of wealth and art that seems to appear in Athens. And it's during this bit that something like the Parthenon, which is iconic even today of Greek culture and architectural beauty, this is when this is constructed and dedicated.
And so we will be coming back to the Parthenon later, so we will sort of compartmentalize that there, but you carry on.
And so while a lot of the other, most of the other states are being exploited and potentially losing their autonomy and being overruled by Athens at the top of the this so-called league, Athens is really enjoying a new level of prosperity, really. Under the guise of it deserved it because it was the city that got sacked during the Persian Wars. So if any city deserves all this wealth and architecture, it's Athens.
That's fair. What about the Roman developments? Is there a similar reason why this becomes the Golden Age? And like you said, this has been recently revised. So is there a particular reason for that? Is there, because, you know, a lot of the things that Gibbons did sort of, I guess, tagged as Golden Ages or anything else have been going a lot of revision lately in different periods and whatnot. But I've noticed, at least from my side of things in the historiographical record, that he's been getting a lot of slack in the Roman side of things, which I found is quite interesting, since he was sort of the blueprint for this type of terminology in many ways. So why that revisionism? What's so special before? Not that, you know, Trajan and the rest weren't awesome, but what makes the other emperors so crucial for this Golden Age?
Well, so to begin with, Gibbons is very caught up in the whole kind of neoclassical romanticism that kind of comes about during the 18th, the 17th, 18th centuries. He's very caught up in that. So he one of his famous quotes is that he cannot think of any greater age of mankind than during the second century under the rulerships of the five good emperors. Obviously, as classical studies and ancient history has developed in academia, and people are becoming more critical of the sources, and nothing's being taken at face value, this is when Gibbons is kind of being questioned, because we're looking deeper into the sources. We're not just kind of looking at what the Historia Augusta might say, or Cassius Dio, or anyone that we're actually questioning these, and a lot of the developments are coming hand in hand with archaeology as well. Mm. So the two previously were very separate. And if you kind of told an orthodox classicist, "Oh, I might include some archaeology," they kind of laugh you out of their posh study. So archaeology can complement classics very well, but it can also be a great source of contradiction to what the sources tell us, and I'm sure you know this already. Yeah. Obviously, pretty obvious. So it started getting reviewed, and obviously, but you've got this period of the Pax Romana, this Roman peace. And while no one is denying that wars were still being fought, this was a period of peace that had been born after almost a century of civil wars. For the Romans, it was the fall of the Republic, in all but name. War hungry generals were fighting each other. Most notably, Julius Caesar and Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus. And you then got obviously Octavian and people like Mark Antony. And when Octavian becomes kind of a last man standing, and he's now got all the power, the way that he kind of reforms the political and most importantly the military structure of the Roman world, this then ushers in this Roman peace. And effectively, there are still wars going on, but they're technically outside the Roman Empire, because you've got to go outside the frontier to go to the wars. But inside the Roman Empire, and it's where I like to term this now the Roman world, because it is its own entity in a way. There are no wars, there are no civil wars. Things are relatively peaceful. You still get the odd rebellion, going on, and that does kind of start slandering the name. So kind of even the Pax Romana now is really being called, well, is it a golden age? Is it really a Roman peace? Again, it's caught up with so much propaganda that was being used at the time as well. So, with the five good emperors, the reason they're kind of called this is because, again, the Trajan comes after, or it actually starts with Nerva, and he came after an emperor called Domitian, and Domitian was a right, sorry for the language, but a right bastard.
He was vicious.
He was sadistic. He was the one where it was said that if he smiled at you, you should be scared, because he was already planning your death. He knew this. He was so paranoid that he was said to have in his palace a hallway full of mirrors so that he could never see anyone sneaking up behind him to assassinate him. He's not a particularly nice guy. And sadly, his rule really puts a shadow and a stain on previous emperors. So we all know of Tiberius, and we all know that Tiberius is seen as quite a bad emperor, but actually he's not that bad. It's only because he's put in such a bad light by a guy called Tacitus, who is writing under the rule of Domitian. And he's basically, because Domitian said, oh, I Tiberius is my idol, he's kind of gone, oh, right, well, this Tiberius guy must have been a right arse. If you're such a horrible person, and you're basing your rulership on him, so the five good emperors come after Domitian, and again, it's a period of relative peace. Domitian was part of the Flavian dynasty, and that only came into power because of civil wars. So we've already got all these civil wars going on again. The five good emperors come, and they start doing prosperity, and Trajan specifically, because he expands the empire to its most largest state. He goes into Dacia, which is kind of modern day Romania, and he conquers it, and he rules over Rome at its largest extent, so at its most powerful, in a way. And nothing really happens with these emperors. There's no great big conspiracies. There's no great slanders or anything. They actually try and do the best job they can. Yes, there are still some revolts, and Hadrian, there's a Jewish revolt, there's a British revolt, but he does a lot of good as well. And they generally try, there's a view, but they generally try to make the empire work, and they're trying their best. And the reason they're known as the best is because during the succession as well, they don't have, the succession doesn't go down to their son or anything. These people aren't related. You become a successor because the emperor has chosen you, because they truly believe you are the best guy for the job. Mm. So it's not this whole family, blood, family line rubbish, which was causing so many problems previously. They thought, well, yes, I could give it to my son. However, this guy here has already proven to be a really good leader, really good statesman, everything else. You know what? He's going to be in charge. And that itself was so different. If you look at the whole of the Roman Empire, that was such a different thing to happen. And that's also why it kind of stands out as the supposed golden age, or why Gibbons also saw it as predominantly the golden age.
That makes sense. Excellent. Well, now that we have the background sort of context and knowledge, it would be now a good time to move on to the art that is flourishing over these periods. So, Annalise, if you wouldn't mind going over to Greece, let's start with Greece, just to make things sort of chronological somehow. Even though I appreciate there is a lot of crossover and a lot of Greek influences that end up, you know, appearing in Rome. What do you think is the reason why Greek art and architecture during this period is so revered, and what makes it so amazing? And any examples that you want to throw along the way, please do.
Well, that was a great historical background. I was absolutely blown away. So thank you for setting the stage for my little art historical analysis.
You're welcome. Normally I get people saying thank God. Yeah.
it was awesome. I was like so engrossed with it. So I think part of the reason is it's important to remember that a lot of our historical background and ideas come from people that were not necessarily working in that period.
Yes.
For example, the Parthenon, and then another statue, which I'm going to talk about for ancient Greece called Doryphorus. They were rediscovered in a later era. And so they are seen through those eyes, and they were seen as the peak of human achievement in art and architecture. So it's important to remember that what I'm talking about wasn't necessarily the Greek or Roman views of the art. It's mm-hmm. just become a part of the established art historical canon over the years from historians such as Giorgio Vasari in the 16th century.
Yes.
And then you have Johann Winckelmann working in the 17th century. But, you know, we can still appreciate it for what it is. It is beautiful, no matter what, in my opinion. So I'm going to start off with the Parthenon. Pretty much everybody knows what the Parthenon looks like. It's become a symbol of ancient Greece over the centuries. So if people are listening to this while driving, don't Google it. But if you're not, Google it and follow along. So this is the main temple on the Acropolis. The Acropolis is a holy site overlooking Athens. You know, Athens was the center of everything, as we heard, and it was dedicated to their patron goddess, Athena. And it was built between 448 and 437 BCE, when Athens was at the height of its power. They wanted to honor the goddess Athena, thank her for her blessings and giving them all of this power on the Greek islands. And it is a Doric style temple. And this is the earliest Greek style that kind of become famous for the three styles. It's Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian in chronological order. So they kind of, to me, look like flat pancakes. A little squished, a little chunky, but you know, it still works. It holds up the stone just fine.
I love it.
That's how I always remembered it, as like the chunky one, you know. It's still cute, but it's not as trim and fancy as the other ones. And basically what they did is they did a platform with three steps up into the sanctuary, but you had to walk past two rows of Doric columns. So it was an experience. You had to walk, you had to participate to get into the holy area itself. And we do see this across other cultures, such as the Jewish temple or Christian cathedrals. Mm-hmm. So it's not an uncommon style for architecture. And it does date back to ancient Greece, that idea of sacred being held within. But another really important part of the Parthenon is its sculpture series along the frieze and the metopes. Today we know them as the Elgin marbles, because the British Lord Elgin actually brought them back to England when Greece was ruled by the Turks. It's extremely controversial. The British Museum has them and mm-hmm. the Acropolis Museum doesn't. I won't get into it, but it's a fascinating bit of rabbit hole research if you do want to look into it. They're stunning. It shows processions of people going to go honor Athena with animal sacrifices and flowers and food. There's some ancient mythology scenes like the Battle of the Centaurs versus the Lapiths that have this tremendous sense of movement and lifelike. It's just stunning that they were able to make marble into these scenes that would have been seen, you know, from the ground and reminded people of why Athena was so powerful. And it is important to note with all of these pieces that I'm going to be talking about today is that they were once painted. They weren't white marble like we see them today. They were brightly painted in primary colors. To me, because I'm a 21st century viewer, I think it's quite garish. But to the ancient viewer, it was like, wow, this is like Technicolor, you know, color TV situation. It was bright. Yeah. It would have been a way to bring the story to life. So I try and remember to look through it through that lens, but I don't like little reproductions online where it looks like it's just ugly.
It's something we're just not used to.
Exactly.
I think I've seen the one statue of, I think, Augustus, isn't it?
Augustus of Pomaporta.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah, but that's that one. Yeah, but... Yeah, that's that always looks a bit weird. It's said to be with the original kind of color tone and texture and everything. And they based it on some slight pigments that they've actually managed to find on the statue itself.
Yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't look strange. It doesn't look quite right. Yeah.
So I think we all associate marble with ancient Greek and Rome. It's like, it's the artistic standard to our modern eyes. And so seeing it colored is just bizarre, but you know, whatever works. It was a different time. This was a time of rediscovering the way that the human body worked and understanding that we aren't made of marble, we're made of flesh. And so that is a way to be manipulated differently. It was a way that people kind of looked at themselves and looked at their fellow man and thought, how can we represent this? Before this period, things were very stiff and geometric, but because Athens was so powerful, there was time for artistic exploration as opposed to fighting for survival. And so this is why we see such a boom in classical Greek architecture and art. So are there any questions about the Pantheon or the Parthenon before I move on to our next statue?
If I can put a slight historical bit of context to the Parthenon as
absolutely.
Well, you're talking about I think the mythological scene is the party that gets disrupted by the centaurs, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, correct.
I can't quite remember who the people are in it or the actual title of the scene, but right. there's been a lot of discussion on that. And again, going back to the Parthenon itself is said to have been constructed from the funds of the Delian League, and it was a way of again Athens claiming that they deserved this because there'd been such the city had been ransacked by the Persians. And because the centaurs are kind of half man, half horse, what a lot of the Eastern military powers often have is a lot of horse archers. And centaurs as well are also very famed for their archery skills. So although the scene is this mythological scene, what it actually is the human, the Athenians fighting against the mythological form of the Persian Empire. So these centaurs are representing horse archers from the Persians.
Yeah. Okay.
I have not heard that before, and I think that is, I'm blown away by that theory. That is fascinating.
It makes total sense
to me, though.
Yeah. Oh, well, I agree with it. I think it is.
I mean, this is the whole idea of the centaur actually representing a lot of Eastern cultures that were somehow seen as an invader or whatever, actually carries on later, and we see this sometimes in the Middle Ages as well. So it is an unknown topic, but I wasn't aware that it was such a specific case scenario here in the Parthenon in that sense. But that's pretty cool.
That's amazing. I'm like blown away by that. It makes total sense. It's a pretty famous myth, and then to appropriate it for an actual historical context for decoration is brilliant.
Can you remind me what the three different style, what the difference is between the three different styles of the Ionian and the Corinthian?
Oh, of course.
I think that's relating to pillar design, isn't it?
It is. That is correct. So Doric is the one that the Parthenon is, and it is a little bit skinny on the top, and it gets wider as you go down to the base, and it's got fluting, so the lines carved into it. And this was the first instance where they were trying to figure out how columns worked, how they could support these large, mostly temple structures. And then we move into the Ionic, which they had figured out you can make things a little bit skinnier, so they're more simple in shape, so they are all kind of the same size as they go down. There's a little bit of variation that they would do in order to give it a straight appearance from all different angles, you know, kind of trick the eye with perspective. And at the top, which is called the capital, they would have these kind of little swirly-doos on the top for decoration.
Oh, yeah.
And then we move into the Corinthian period, and that's when things got super fancy. That was when people, they had their stuff down, they knew what they were doing architecturally, so then they could expand into decoration. And those are the ones that have kind of the flowery leaves on the top of the capital, the prettiest ones in most people's opinion. And those were first seen in Corinth, which is why we call them Corinthian columns.
These are also the ones that then the Romans hijack for most of their agglomerated stuff.
Well, it didn't hijack. Incorporate. Everything's incorporated.
We all knew. So
I think incorporated is a nice word for hijack.
Incorporation. You know.
So is this the kind of
it's not acculturation, it's incorporated.
Yeah, sure. Let's go with that.
So that's probably the type that most people are familiar with. probably lasted the longest, did it? Or
yeah, I would say so. Not just because
the prettiest one, some people like it.
Right.
Yeah, it's not just because it's so visual as well. It became, like I said, once it gets incorporated into Roman culture, you almost see it anywhere that has a proper developed Roman structure. It sort of becomes the capital per se. And then it also lays, not in all cases, but a very good foundation for a lot of the Paleo-Christian architecture and later on medieval architecture as well. And obviously later on, it gets reappropriated in neoclassicism and so on and so forth, because those camphor motifs, that it's actually what the leaves are called, they just have a nice sort of shape to them, and they're quite versatile, so they cannot, you know, they can move on and transit, they become like a transitional element throughout history, which is why it becomes so appealing. But anyway, capitals aside, yeah, well, there you go. Capitals aside, I think Annalisa was about to move on to another Greek piece, which is the Doryphorus. Am I correct?
I mean, I don't speak Greek, but that's how I've always said it with my Pacific Northwest accent. So I'm going to go with that. And I apologize if I say it wrong and somebody gets mad. So I chose this sculpture to talk about because it is one of the iconic sculptures of classical Greece. It dates roughly around the same time as the Parthenon, around 440 BCE. And it's actually, we know the artist's name. He was a man named Polyclitus. And when you Google it and you go, the Wikipedia page has a great image. You know, Wikipedia can be a little bit of a weird source, but the images are usually pretty spot on. So it's important to note that this is a Roman marble copy of the lost original Greek bronze.
You're welcome.
Bronze was a really valuable metal box in ancient times. So they melted it down for weapons, but we have excellent documentation that this is a pretty spot-on copy. So it's been accepted in the art historical canon. It is quite large, about 7 feet tall. I don't know how tall that is in meters. I'm sorry, America's not on the metric system. So I apologize for that. And his name, Doryphorus, it means spear bearer. So his left hand is kind of cupped as if he would be holding a spear resting against his left shoulder. And the reason that this is so famous is because it represents what we call the canon of Polyclitus. It's an art historical term that is basically the perfect human proportions. He was seen as, this is what man looks like, this is how he would look as if he was frozen in stone as opposed to we carved him from stone. Before him, in the archaic Greek period, art was very stylized, it was geometric. Sphere for a head, kind of an upside down triangle for the shoulders and torso, and a long rectangle for the legs. It was formulaic. There, of course, there was creativity. I don't want to bash the archaic Greeks, but it was very formulaic. Whereas with Polyclitus and the Doryphorus, it was much more naturalistic. And we get this from a word called contrapposto. It essentially means it's a natural pose with a weight shifting on the hips. So when you stand up and you're just standing there, you don't stand stick straight. You kind of lean to one side. For me, I lean to my left and put most of my weight on my left foot while my right hip kind of pushes forward. And that's just a natural human pose of, I don't know the biological reason for it because I'm an art historian, but that's just kind of how we stand. And before that, weight was shifted equally between each leg in sculpture. We see it in the archaic Greeks, in the ancient Near East, in ancient Egypt, not really in the prehistoric times because we don't have a ton of sculpture from them. But up until this point, we didn't have contrapposto. So this is really one of the first times we see it, and it blew people out of the water. We were shocked by it. They were, wow, we can actually show ourselves in art. And so we have a ton of sculptures of people doing normal things, holding a sphere, cleaning themselves off, pulling a thorn out of their foot, and it looks as if they're frozen. I'm just blown away by that discovery. It's such a simple thing, but it makes all the difference in art.
Yeah,
it makes sense, and it's probably such a it's such a valuable discovery for us, not simply from an art perspective, but because we have these images of these people doing simple things, like holding a spear or washing themselves. It gives us such a better insight into how people were going about those activities during the day.
They're looking at themselves.
Yes.
I'm trying to understand themselves as humans. They weren't just a group. They were individuals, and they were trying to understand how individual bodies worked.
Yeah.
That's probably such a revolutionary idea if you're people that have this belief that you're from the mold of the same god kind of thing. So we think about their mythology and their historical mythological beliefs to see these people as complete individuals, and to have that highlighted in art was probably just an exciting, as you said, just an exciting new discovery that and probably a new way of seeing yourself and thinking.
He's also super muscular, so that probably helped people later be like, yeah, I could achieve that. I could be cut like that guy. I mean, I'm not opposed to the idea.
Probably.
That was something I was actually going to go into, because there is another very famous statue. The Discobolus is also that type of statue that has such a realism in muscle and in, these type of statues are really glorifying not just the human anatomy, but also the, athleticism of human anatomy, which was, of course, an important part of Greek culture. So in a way, they become standards of what anyone else from that moment on should be achieving if you want to be on that league, not just, in the sense of being a man of art, but in the sense of being a successful person, an athletic person, someone who is also a good contributor towards society. Because in the general context of all of these statues happening in Athens, Pericles, who is in charge of Athens during that time, what he's really trying to promote is that this is what you can achieve when you have such a society as Athens to back you up. So it's a weird way of saying, I'm so big and muscular because Athens is cool, which is...
So there's always going to be some propaganda stuck in there somewhere.
Exactly. So, there is definitely some political and cultural agendas in there that, have to be taken into consideration. But
I'm really glad you brought that up, actually, because one of the ideas behind the Doryphoros, even though he was just the spear bearer, he's not the spear guy fighting at the moment.
Yes.
He represents the ideal male heroic nude. And that's an idea that we see throughout history. I mean, all the way up until the Renaissance, when these sculptures were being uncovered in the Italian peninsula. This one was discovered in the area around Naples, in fact. And, we see works of like Michelangelo, for example, and how he painted everybody in the Sistine Chapel as the heroic male nude. Even the women, kind of, because he had probably never seen a woman before. But it's that idea that travels through history. And I mean, some of it got covered up because the Pope was a little bit scandalized. But I digress. It's an idea that has come through us through history of like these heroic battles, the Trojan War, the Iliad, the Odyssey. And so it's fascinating to me how these ideas can still go down through history, even into our modern era, but they're the same ideas that were held back in the day. And it shows how humans, we don't change much. We do change and we do evolve, but there are some ideas that we just get stuck on. I mean, I know you guys don't live in America, but we like American football players. They're idolized for their heroics on the field and their muscular form. I mean, we just had the Super Bowl last weekend, and it was all about, the figures and the fighting on the field. And that could be akin to ancient Greece and ancient Rome.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Sports culture and all of that is also a sense of pride and national identity, of course. And it's such a big aspect of both examples, ancient Greece and current day in America. But anyway, before I go into a whole different cultural topic, which is sports and the important contribution of sports, not just to art, but to history, which I could go on forever. And I bet that's not something you guys were expecting to hear in a podcast about art. That's what makes this statue so amazing and really sets, that bar. And I mean, I could go on forever and ever, and I have literally such a long list of other bits and bobs that apply here. But I also become self-conscious that we haven't even got to Roman history, and we're already more than halfway through. So maybe if we speed things up, unless James wants to throw any little more nuggets before we move on to his period.
I don't actually know that much about the Dorophorus statue of the spear bearer. So he's obviously holding a spear. Is he meant to be holding a shield as well? Is the shield meant to be attached to his other?
No, so the spear doesn't survive. We know from the way from other pieces that they're not as good copies, that he did have the spear, and that's how we came to that conclusion. But actually his right hand is down by his side. So there, he wouldn't have probably been holding a shield, but maybe in some copies he was, but in the ones that survive today, there's no evidence.
I was going to say, that's actually one of the reasons why a lot of art historians and just general classicists believe that he was more likely to be an athlete than a soldier in that sense, because we don't have any evidence of how that shield would have been in context, and because we have these other pieces such as this Cobulus happening at the same time, and obviously the Olympic Games were starting to be kind of a big deal during this time period, it's one of the reasons why there is more of a tendency to think that this was more likely to be an athlete than a soldier. And if I remember this correctly, although I could be potentially wrong, it's also the way that the hand has been crafted to hold the spear. It doesn't look like it would be like the throw seems to be more to do with the actual sport or even hunting rather than actual fighting itself, because literally the degree of detail that goes into making this one hand and the hold of the spear itself, it just doesn't seem practical for what you would expect a fighter to do with a spear in that time period. There will be photos of this, by the way, on the feed when we put the thing up. So you guys will be able to sort of see the references as well. But anyway, this just one thing to keep in mind. It may be a bit difficult to actually zoom into the hand and actually see. But it is one of the reasons why the theory kind of goes down that road.
It's an interesting pose because the angle of the spear is actually quite reminiscent to how Roman soldiers carry the pilum, kind of at that angle over the shoulder.
I suppose it's just a comfortable way of doing it.
It is, yeah, and it could also be how hoplite soldiers carried the spear when marching as well. You know, you wouldn't obviously have it down by your side all the time. That would just kill your arm. You'd likely have it over your shoulder, along with anything else you might be carrying. It's just very interesting that it seems to be that the spear's in the left hand. Is that of noteworthiness?
That I don't know. I do understand what you're saying because most people are right-handed, but I don't know. I have not heard anything of that nature.
It would make me think this is probably more an athlete or so. Yeah, I mean, if it was designed to glorify kind of the more martial aspect of man, then I would presume the spear would be shown in the right hand, as all the sources kind of point that you had to fight with the spear in the right hand, particularly in a hoplite phalanx as well. So yeah, it's very. I'm going to do some more reading into it. It's a very interesting. Yeah. I'd love to hear more about it as well.
There is one more technical thing to consider here that is. And again, I don't really want to go into sort of the very hardcore technical side of things, but the type of technique that Dorophorus actually uses to do the sculpture, it's, I'm not going to say revolutionary because perhaps revolutionary is not the right word, but this technique that includes movement is heavily based on contraposition. So you need to create that sort of two different types of movement in the human body to give it that sort of sense of solidity, but also realism. So I don't know if maybe there is a possibility that the reason why he chose to do it on the left-hand side is to give that sort of idea of flow and movement instead of on the right-hand side, just for creative purposes. I don't know. But there is, as far as I'm concerned, there is no specific, you know, theories as to why one hand or the other hand or anything like that. But anyway, there you go. That's James's random examination of a Greek statue may solve the query as to whether it was athlete or a warrior. You never know. but yeah, we'll be moving on to the Roman Golden Age or so-called Roman Golden Age. For that, I mean, we can go on and on and on for ages and ages and ages. I have a particular piece of architecture that I would like to talk about, but it's probably not the first one that comes in the list if we're thinking about chronology. So which ones did you have in your list, Annalisa?
I was going to discuss the Areopagus, which was under Augustus, you know, the first emperor's reign, and then Trajan's Column, which is about 100 to 113 CE.
Yes, so I believe the Areopagus is probably first in the chronology itself. Yes. So, so let's talk about the Areopagus Augusta, which is technically the full name. I don't know if any of you wants to go first or anything. Please feel free. Otherwise, I'll talk about the bit that interests me.
should I give a little bit of context on it?
Yeah, go for it.
For sure.
So the Areopagus Augusta is also known, it translates as the Altar of Peace. It was dedicated by the Senate after Augustus returned, most notably from his campaigns in Hispania or modern-day Spain, those crazy Spanish. always causing trouble. I know Spanish. I know the Spanish, and that's exactly why I said it.
and I am from the part that gave them hell. So yeah, you are them right.
Yeah. you're just troublemakers. Although I should thank you, because if you hadn't have done that, maybe we wouldn't have the Areopagus.
This
so
is
actually,
very true.
Thank you. Thank you for causing trouble. It's dedicated to. It's dedicated to Augustus, and it's most notably dedicated to this newborn Pax Romana, this Roman peace, but also known as the Augustan peace during this Augustan peace during this period as well. It's a beautiful, beautiful specimen. I won't go into the details of it because I'm sure both of you will be able to do it a lot more justice than I will. But it was a functioning altar in some points. Sadly, it did get demolished at some point during history, but it was actually restored by Mussolini, the dictator of Italy. Yeah, he as much as he is a bad person, and I'm not trying to condone or anything he did. I can't dismiss that he did actually do a lot for Roman history in the sense that a lot now of what we can go and visit was actually down to him. So
obviously he had his reasons, but yeah
of course, nationalism.
he had the reasons but nonetheless it is because of him that you can now go and visit this beautiful monument face to face. So it was located in the Campus Martius, or the Field of Mars, so just on the kind of the other side of the western side of the Tiber, and it shows a sacrificial procession. But the way it's done it, there seems to be lots of hidden messages, and people will argue about this until they're blue in the face about what these messages could be. But it could be that it's showing not only prosperity and peace, but with hints of danger. So don't take this for granted, because there's always danger lying about. And there's also the issue that Augustus was very pro kind of family values. He wanted to take Romans back to the traditional values, and one of them specifically was families. He even brought in a law trying to stop things like adultery, and actually to have benefits that promoted having a family. And this is very much shown on the Arapakis through a united imperial family. And there's also little hints in there as well that this glory is from the subjectification of other peoples. So there are two children located in this possession, and they're wearing torques around the necks, and they're kind of their positioning is kind of like they're trying to get the attention of one of the Roman women in the image. And again, this could just be two children from the imperial families. Could be Gaius or Lucius, but another theory, and this is my personal take on it as well, is that these children actually represent obsides. So these are hostages taken from client kingdoms, and probably most notably from Britain at this particular period in history. And these are children that are given a great education, great life and everything else, but they are there as a reassurance from the client kingdoms that they won't be causing any trouble. So there is that hint of prosperity, but also that hint of kind of threatening nature as well. That forever, that always lurk, that is always lurking there.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, now that we know that, let's dig into the Arapakis itself as an artistic. Is it fair to say, I don't like calling it just a piece because it's sort of a piece made out of many pieces. Can we say an artistic compound, maybe? I don't know what your take is on this, but what can you tell us about this? Let's go with artistic thing, just to make it more user-friendly.
No, I think that's a great way to describe it. And thank you for that awesome background on the piece and the history of why it was created. That set my stage very well. And yes, it could be it is a piece made of many pieces. There are multiple panels, there's stairs, there's architecture, there's relief carvings. So it is a conglomeration of pieces. And we see a lot of different symbolism, and that was already kind of touched on briefly, so I won't go into everything. But I did want to discuss how we can kind of see the inspiration of classical Greece in this work that had been passed down. For example, it's kind of similar to the frieze on the Parthenon. We see a true sense of three-dimensionality, not only in the fact that the figures jut out from the walls of the Arapakis, but we also see the intricate folds of their clothing and their architectural details, such as the Corinthian style columns. This is a great discussion point back to our discussion on the Parthenon. There are Corinthian columns that are decorated not with the fluting, so the simple lines, but additional vegetal pieces. Mm-hmm. And that was to remind the viewer or the attendants or the supplicants that Augustus's tours in Gaul and Hispania and Great Britain were to bring peace and prosperity to the nation. This was a couple of decades after his conquering of Egypt, for example, as Octavian in the Battle of Actium against Cleopatra and Mark Antony. And that was a really big deal because Egypt was so prosperous in things like wheat. So he was bringing peace, prosperity, food, money, all of these important things into the Roman Empire. And that would bring peace, hence the altar dedicated to Pax, or the goddess of peace. And it's just fascinating that the way the structure has been rebuilt. I mean, Mussolini, horrible guy, we can all agree on that. But he did save the Arapakis, and our historians have studied it for decades, mm-hmm. because not all of it could be saved. And if you look on the Wikipedia images, they do have some pieces that are only partially restored, and the rest they kind of fill in with drawings. And there's just a multitude of figures. We've got the imperial family. We've got attendants to the goddess Pax. There's animals that are getting ready to sacrifice. And each one of these was developed in a specific artistic style to show things veristically, or more truthfully. So they appear as they would have in life, but they look really good. So there's also a little bit of stylization there. And just this combination of two styles really speaks to the development of Roman art. And that's why I wanted to discuss it today.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a wonderful piece because it talks about so many things in a, well, let's say fairly small in comparison to, you know, other bigger structures. It's just telling you about all the social political context that Rome is just transitioning into. It's giving you the whole Augustan agenda of I am the best person ever and anyone should be happy to be Roman under my domain. You know, it's giving you so many different layers. And on top of that, like you said, it's also hailing back to the great work of Phidias, particularly back in ancient Greece, showing how art in a way has sort of evolved but maintained itself, which I think is one of the most interesting aspects of this piece. It's almost like Greek art on steroids part two, which is you know amazing. And one of the things that I really love about this piece, and this is going to be perhaps a very art historian term, sorry if some of you don't get it, but it's very Baroque in the sense of, you know, it's so busy, there is so much stuff going on, you can almost pick one person, one little scene, and do a whole commentary just on them, and do that through, you know, the whole four panels, which is madness, you know. And I generally mean Baroque, and in a way almost Rococo, because it generally goes over the top, and it's quite fascinating. And for me, the most amazing thing is really how they've built the perspective levels. You know, you have the underrelief, then you have the relief, then you have the overrelief, and it just creates that sort of 3D element that it's not very common to see at later stages. You know, we really struggle with that when we go into medieval art, and it will not be until the Renaissance when we really see this sort of idea of depth and 3D imaging in a way, which is really remarkable. And the Arapakis, I think, is such a wonderful example of that specific type of technique, because it's really hard. You know, you need to have a really degree type of mastery to be able to achieve such a general conceptualization of that 3D aspect without having modern tools.
Is there any idea of why that was so hard to achieve later on until the Renaissance?
I mean, that's an entire podcast on its own. But it's just a matter of changes in how art develop, because, well, we will get into that at some other point. But yes, it's changes in art, changes in technology, some supposed loss of knowledge. We will not go into that. But the nature of art also goes into other mediums. A lot of medieval art actually happens on manuscript, not so easy to achieve that with ink and just a parchment piece. So, you know, there is several reasons for it. But yeah, we will talk about it in a different podcast.
This 3D effect that the Romans had, it is something that seems to have disappeared. Because it was quite common, particularly in Italian villas. It's called stucco.
Yes.
Okay.
Stucco wallpaper, and it's effectively 3D reliefs. It's incredible to see in the person. For anyone that's in Britain, it's incredibly rare in Britain. In fact, there's only about one main kind of source to go and see it, and that's a Fishbourne Roman palace. Where there's quite some nice examples. There are some examples in the British Museum as well, but they're from foreign locations. Here in Britain, it's incredibly rare, and Fishbourne's one of the only places to see it. But it is very impressive. Obviously, it's more made out of plaster stucco work, so it's not necessarily made out of marble like the alpacas, but it's still this same kind of intention of creating this 3D this 3D image.
Excellent. Right. Before we move on to the later stuff with Trajan, I thought James wanted to talk briefly about some Augustan sculpture.
when you're talking about Augustan, to me, the golden age of Rome is Augustus. And I would class it as Augustus only. There's just so much good that he kind of does, and he's a top lad. He's a top boy.
He's a fanboy. Such a fanboy. Calm down.
I love him. And but he, there's so much architecture, and you talk it when we're talking about Golden Age Rome's. The Alpac is such a fantastic example, and thank you for the breakdown into it. There's some stuff that I hadn't actually realized myself. So thank you. That was really fascinating. But it's only one of so many pieces that you start developing. You've got the Pantheon, you've got the temple, you've got the Theatre of Marcellus. He restores so much as well. In fact, you've got the famous quote from Suetonius that says that Augustus founded Rome a city of brick and left it a city of marble. He has such this artistic revolution that happens in the city, as well as outside in different colonies that he sets up. People are setting up these mimicry forums. But one of the main ones I really wanted to point out in this is the Augustan Forum. Have you done much with this one alongside the Alpacas at all?
I actually spent a lot of time in Rome, so I've been to all these places. And been able to see them and physically encounter them and understand them from that angle. And I will say for the record, I am an Augustus fangirl as well. So I'm right there with you.
New history, bringing Augustan fans together. You said it here first.
we're a dying breed.
How? Yeah, how is that even possible?
Huh?
How is that even possible? I thought this was fairly common, but the more I look into it, I realize it's not. But anyway, we digress.
Yeah. But the Augustan Forum is incredible because it's not only is it such an expression of artistic skill and everything else. It's an entire forum built next to or just kind of across from the Forum Romanum. But it just has, again, like the Alpacas, it's just such a staple of what Augustus had brought to it. It's made of different components. It has the Temple of Mars Ota, Mars the Avenger, dedicated to it. It was used for public selling and trading, but also law matters as well. But the main stuff I wanted to point to was they're called the Summi Viri, or the Summi Viri, and they're statues along the two colonnades. As you walk into the forum, if you looked to your left and your right, you'd see these colonnades of statues going all the way down the forum, and they're all looking towards a central statue of Augustus, of a golden statue of Augustus in a four-horse quadriga. And on the on one side, you'd have notable figures of Roman history. So you'd have people like Scipio Africanus, the defeater of Hannibal, and then the defeater of Carthage. You'd have all these notable figures of general Roman history going down one side, but on the other side, you'd have Augustus's own heritage and his lineage going all the way back to someone called Aeneas. And Aeneas, again, is a top lad. He's the son of Venus. He's the son of Venus. And this is so important because what this forum does is it's physically showing the Golden Age, because Augustus is a golden statue in this forum.
Right.
all these statues are looking towards him. So you've got all this great moments of Roman history. You've got all these glorious individuals that have spread Roman power, that have brought Rome to new greatness, but they're all kind of overshadowed by this new figure that is Augustus. And the fact that he so clearly dates his claims his origin and even traces his origin all the way back to a divine being. It's huge. So he's not only brought along this golden age, but this golden age was prophesied by the gods themselves. He's almost like a Roman Jesus. I like to see him as a Roman.
I'm sure you do.
He's this embodiment of a god, effectively, and he's brought about this whole new age,
right?
And the forum is just such a landmark of what he what's been, not only what he's achieved, but just what Romans have achieved in general.
Mm.
And it's such a fantastic, I could talk about the Augustan form for ages. There. I know we need to move on.
Yes.
To something else, but yes. It's, yeah. But
and don't worry, for those of you who want to hear it, I can't believe I'm actually saying this, but there will be a day when James will just
Yay.
Have his little Augustan fanboy rant
Yay.
Here in New History. So there you go. Look forward to that day, which unfortunately is not today. But yeah, as we move on, I'm actually going to take this to my favorite Roman emperor. Sorry, I am a loud one as well, as much as I'm not a big fan of the Romans. But one of the reasons why I want to take this to Trajan, before we go to Trajan's column, is because Trajan did a great thing, in my opinion, which was really pushing for the development of the empire from an architectural point of view that we are very lucky to have such an amazing historical record of it in Spain. And one of the great things he did was really pushing for those civic structures. And we don't really talk about them a lot in art history, mostly because a lot of art historians sometimes look at these civic buildings or public structures as sort of feats of engineering rather than art, when in fact they are both. And you cannot really achieve one without the other, I don't think. So the piece I wanted to talk about is, I mean, it's an amazing UNESCO site, which is right in the middle of Spain in Segovia, and it's the aqueduct. This is actually one of the best, if not the best preserved Roman aqueduct in the world. And it's huge. It literally measures 818 meters long and 56 meters tall. It's massive. It pretty much takes over the entire center of Segovia, which is, well, much, much more developed during the Middle Ages. But it's fascinating when you just walk into this wonderful medieval town, which was really important during the Spanish medieval times, and particularly during the Golden Age, and you actually do it through this huge structure that had been there way before the Visigoths went and took over that part of Spain, and obviously a lot longer before the Catholic kings and later emperors develop the sort of middle of Spain. You literally go into the city center through the arches of the aqueduct, and it just goes around the entire place. It's fascinating. Mm. We don't actually know who the main engineer or artist was for it. We probably think there was a combination of several of them, simply because it's so big. You know, you couldn't probably have one person working on it. And it was done during the period of Trajan, roughly around the 100. But it's wonderful because this whole structure is just built in pieces of granite without any form of cement or, compound to keep this together. It's literally just standing there. Still today, there are some small repairs, obviously, but, you know, in the majority of it, it's just massive blocks of granite stuck on each other. And in total, it's two full arches that you have super, you know, one above the other. The one thing that I really like about this, and again, the reason why I really like these type of artistic pieces of the civic and public sphere, is because they really encompass three Roman virtues, which I think were really important, not just during Trajan's time, but throughout the general Golden Age, which is the firmitas, utilitas, and venustas. Now, firmitas means firm, you know, it's something solid, it's going to be durable, it represents, you know, the empire is here to stay. Utilitas, which obviously serves a function, in this case, well, aqueduct, there you go, that's what it does, and venustas essentially comes to exemplify that despite this thing being solid and utile, it's also beautiful. And you know, it's, you cannot say that about many modern buildings this day that are, you know, firm and utilitarian. But for Roman society, this was part of their pride and joy. You know, it's the same reason why a lot of triumphal arches also follow these three principles, because it was another way of showing that the beauty and glory of Rome was not just, you know, under the tutelage or the patrimony of Augustus and in private villas and all of that. It was part of the state. It was part of their statecraft, of their empire building. And it is very likely that back then, every big or major settlement would have some form of civic art piece that would actually remind you, you are a citizen of Rome, and this is what it looks like. Which obviously, you know, not many of them remain, but this is why I kind of wanted to take it to something that, you know, many people rather would think as a feat of engineering, but actually, if you look at the way all of the pieces have been carved, the way it's built, it is art. And, you know, that's important. Another thing which is quite sort of controversial, but very important here for the context of Rome and Spain, and obviously during Trajan's reign, is the fact that a massive construction of that couldn't have been built without a ridiculous amount of slaves. And we have ample evidence of all of the slaves that were brought probably from North Africa, but also perhaps towards the late stages of the construction of the aqueduct. It's likely that some slaves came from the Dacia as well, as he had just conquered it. So it's interesting to think that we wouldn't have such an important part of history in the middle of Spain without ancient slavery, and of course the connotations that that has in later Spanish history, such as modern slavery and whatnot. So it's one of those weird bittersweet stories, like here is this amazing piece that would not have existed if Roman imperialism didn't go hardcore on people.
I think you touch on an important point there in general with a lot of art history, is we forget that a lot of these architectural wonders, as much as we admire them, they were the products of mass slavery. And everything everything we've talked about so far has been, you know, likely the result of a lot of slave exploitation and slave industry at the time.
They are also there to kind of reinforce that as well.
So it's one of those kind of I guess inconvenient truths we may tend to try and overlook sometimes, but it's very difficult to forget.
I think particularly in art history is difficult because, you know, you're seeing these amazing things that are, in my opinion, the epitome of human society, of human culture. You know, guys, I don't study war and warfare because it just kind of makes me think this is the lowest and the harshest moment of humanity. So for me, art is such a wonderful thing, a sort of a little spark of hope that makes me think humans can be so much more. But the sad reality is that sometimes a lot of those wonderful things are based on dark moments of our own humanity, which they just simply need to be acknowledged, whether it was, you know, how many years in the past or in the more recent present. So that was also one of the reasons why I wanted to bring it in, but also because, you know, as we are talking about Trajan anyway, you know, just I figured there was going to be a ridiculous amount of Augustan propaganda in this cast.
he's not a Roman Jesus. I take that a little carried away. He's still, and you can reference this, he's still a top lad.
Anyway, last time I checked, one of the reasons why Trajan is, you know, quite big in the scene is because of Trajan's column. So, Annalisa, could you tell us a bit more about this wonderful thing that it is very interesting and also a little bit controversial at stages. So, tell us more.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Trajan is my other favorite emperor. He's tied with Augustus, so that's probably why I picked these two pieces to talk about.
We need to have a proper chat, because that's the same with me. We need to have a...
Oh, that sounds good to me. So one thing I want to point out about Trajan's column is, and it's with like a lot of Rome, it's just out there. Like, you don't have to go to some special museum to see it. It's just chilling out in the middle of the city. And I, as someone from Seattle, which was, you know, Native American land and then built up in the 19th century, we don't really have that here. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's just fascinating. And it was sculpted between 107 and 113 CE to celebrate, as James talked about, his victory over the Dacians. They're in basically modern day Romania. It's about 90 feet tall. It's very imposing when you walk up to it. And again, I'm sorry for using the not the standard for the rest of the world. And it is where it used to be, the Forum of Trajan. And there are still parts of it that are accessible today,
but the Trajan's Column is really the famous part that remains. And it's just a column with a continuous narrative frieze that spirals upwards. So instead of like the Parthenon and the Areopagus, where things are laid flat out at the top or on the sides of the building, it wraps up kind of like a scroll and tells the viewer the story of Trajan's Dacian campaign. And there's about 2,500 figures total on this column, which is crazy that they took the time to individually show soldiers. There's a few women, there's Dacians, there's horses, there's literally everything that you can need for a military campaign. And Trajan himself is shown about 59 times. And it's not just like a standard, all right, here's the emperor, stamp him on. They actually, the artist took the time to make Trajan look like his self, like the sculptures that survive of him. So that's how we're able to know it's him. Plus, he's shown bigger than everyone else. This is a technique called hierarchy of scale. So the more important you are, the bigger that you're shown in the scene. So the soldiers are smaller. Trajan is the emperor / general. He's bigger than everyone else. And it shows, what I love about it is that it shows all the aspects of a military campaign. And I'm like Lily, I'm not super into the military side of things. I like the art and the literature. But I do like that it shows us that there's a historical record. You know, it's not just, oh, look at Trajan, he's in battle, so cool. No, it shows him, you know, the soldiers cleaning their gear. It shows them leading the horses. It shows some bad things too, like torture and mm-hmm. stuff. But I don't like to look at those parts because it just makes me sad.
Yes.
And it served as the inspiration for many other victory columns that are seen throughout Rome. But this is kind of the most famous one. And it was really made to glorify Trajan and his military campaign. It was voted by the Senate when he passed away that his cremated ashes were placed in a special chamber at the base of the column. So instead of like a mausoleum, as we see with someone like Augustus, he was actually put in his column as a memory of his great victory. And there used to be a statue of him on top, but then the papacy came along and they weren't cool with that. So one of the popes, I think it was Sixtus IV, but I could be wrong, he put a statue of St. Peter up there. Yep. So that's still up there today. It's a little weird because St. Peter didn't have anything to do with Trajan, but you know,
nope.
It works, I guess, in Rome. It is Rome after all.
Yeah, I think I was going to particularly mention that it's, you know, it's one of those funny things that we see that happens so much in history when another culture or a different time comes about and something that just simply looks a bit out of place goes like, oh no, we cannot have that. So they just repurpose to fit their own, you know, morals or ethics or whatever. And we see this a lot with a lot of Greek sculptures or Roman copies of Greek sculptures, particularly in the later periods and when they've already become Christians. And normally when a full Greek statue, like what we were talking about earlier from the Doryphorus, would be, you know, full in nude, suddenly there is a, you know, bit of foliage covering the private parts, or things are suddenly presenting some veils or some draperies where before there was not such a thing and whatnot. And it's pretty much the same thing here with Trajan's Column. You know, this was the thing about Trajan's Column is that the place where it is, like Annalisa said, you can't miss it. You know, it's out there because it was supposed to be out there. You know, this was not just perceived as a piece of art. It was also in a similar way than the aqueduct, a piece of civil engineering. It was a column. It was commemorative, like the triumphal arches. It was supposed to be there to send a message. Trajan rules, period. And it's difficult to have such a clear statement of not just Roman imperialism, but paganism in the middle of a super Catholic country. So, you know, you find ways of essentially syncretizing one thing with the other. This is not uncommon, but it is something that happens a lot. And obviously it creates a weird contextualization for a lot of pieces, because what correlation is there between St. Peter and the statue itself? Nothing. But St. Peter was a way of making such an amazing piece legit. And therefore, that's why now we cannot see the wonderful statue of Trajan that used to actually be on top of the column itself.
Yeah, I see it more as not necessarily the individual of Saint Peter, but what he represents.
So yeah, of course.
The column itself is a testament to conquest.
Yes.
Okay. Trajan, it culminates at the top. Okay, that's the ultimate victory of Trajan is at the top of the
yes, 100%
of the column. Once you put a Christian figure on top of that, the conqueror has become the conquered. And again, remove the individuals. This isn't Trajan now. This is Rome. Rome has been conquered by Christianity. The pagans are now subject to the Christians. That's how I tend to see it.
Yeah, 100%.
It's removing that individual. Mm-hmm.
And Trajan was alive during, you know, the very, very early years of Christianity. And so obviously it wasn't the global religion that it is today, but the inklings were starting. St. Peter was crucified approximately, you know, 64 under the reign of Emperor Nero. And so this was a way for the Christian church to kind of reclaim that history of Rome for themselves, as opposed to, like, you know, Trajan and the pagans.
Exactly. And Christians, they were making the Romans question. The Romans, as you exactly said, Trajan was alive during when the Christians were starting to become more and more prominent, and questions being raised by Roman officials and the elite on how do they deal with them. I don't know if you've heard of the letters of Pliny, but Pliny was a governor in Lithuania. I want to say,
the northern Baltic region.
He was around that area, and there's a lot. He corresponded with Trajan a lot. He was a big fan of Trajan. Some might say he was a bit of a suck up to Trajan. he wanted Trajan's advice for a lot of things, and because of that, he wrote a lot of letters, and he got a lot of letters back from Trajan in return. And luckily, a lot of them have survived. And they're now known as the Letters of Pliny, Pliny the Younger. There was a Pliny the Elder, but he sadly got killed in Vesuvius. So he's the ultimate symbol of burned. I like Pliny the Elder, and he wrote books called the Natural History of
which
the
are
world.
Important.
Yes. And Pliny in these letters, he at one point he's questioning, he needs to deal with these Christians. He doesn't know what to do with them. So he actually asks Trajan what to do. And Trajan doesn't really give a clear answer. He almost says, do what you think is best. You know, so even the guy on top isn't quite sure. Like, you get that sense of uncertainty that this is a new people that have come about. And the Romans aren't. The Romans do get a bit of bad PR with Christians. I'm not saying they were best friends.
Yeah, I wonder why.
I'm not saying they were best friends, but they weren't exactly crucifying Christians and burning them every 5 minutes either. They were.
No, that's later propaganda.
Yeah. So it's they have got an unfair rep when it comes to Christians.
I'm not entirely sure if unfair is the right word. Exaggerated, let's say.
Let's go with that. Exaggerated. Fine, let's go with exaggerated. So they were this up and coming weird people.
And
that's how I kind of saw it. They were kind of like the Jews in this world. The Romans weren't quite sure how to deal with the Jews as such, and that's why you did have, you know, it's factors that led to the Jewish revolt and the second Jewish revolt under Hadrian.
Then you have to remember the Romans, they weren't in the business of telling people they couldn't practice their own religion. They kind of just assimilated it. We see it, you know, in Egypt, where they were it was very popular to have the goddess Isis involved in the new Roman religion after the conquering, after the Battle of Actium, or even in the from the eastern end, where you've got Ishtar and Mithras coming in and being assimilated into Roman culture. So maybe he just wasn't sure, like, maybe we could just bring this Jesus dude into the Roman fray, but clearly that didn't work. But, only a few decades after the crucifixion.
No, you're exactly right. Romans were very tolerant of other religions, and it was almost a case of, as long as your god doesn't cause any trouble, he can come and live with us. It's kind of like, as long as he's a good housemate.
Christian God was not.
No, yeah, it was a case of it was a case of the fact that the Christians had to accept that their God was not the only one, mm-hmm. and they weren't willing mm-hmm. to do that, and that's what caused a lot of the issues. And obviously, this is a period where the gods are not nice people. It's important to remember this as well. No. The gods are not nice people. I mean, I was talking about Domitian being an arse. Jupiter and Zeus, they blow him out of the water. These are not nice people. And because Romans are worshipping them and they're sacrificing them and everything else, it does not mean that the gods were loved.
Yeah.
They were doing this almost out of fear. And there's a great quote from Horace, and it's when you neglect the gods, it will be to the woe of all of Italy. So basically, give respect for gods and acknowledge them and you know, worship them and everything else, but it's not out of love, it's so that they don't come and kick us in the butt, basically. So if the Romans were kind of like accepting and saying, well, okay, you know, yeah, all right, maybe we might say that there's a chance that your God's the only one, they weren't going to say that at all, because then Jupiter would come down with a rain of bolts and be like, yo guys, no, Armageddon time, and you'd have another Pompeii Vesuvius case. So it's important to remember that part as well when we're talking about religion in this period. The gods are not nice people. And they're not this all-loving kind of God that we tend to associate with the Christian God.
Excellent. Well, not excellent, but yes. As a concluding remark, it was excellent, and that's what I meant to say. oh gosh. Anyway, I am very self-conscious of the time and the fact that we've probably run a bit over, but I guess, you know, that's what happens when we get into things that we really, really like. So before we wrap things up, I just wanted to check with Alex. Is there anything anything that we have covered that you think maybe we need to clarify a bit more, or anything that you would like us to sort of, you know, sort of hit the nail and just leave it there as you're sort of smoothing things out between us? And everyone
and listening, and it's been very interesting. You've given a lot of context for, you know, why some of these things were made and you know, the time period and things like that. So that's helped a lot. Yeah, to, you know, a lot of these things I'm already familiar with. I just don't know much about the story behind them.
You don't want to know more about Augustus?
No, not right now.
Maybe next time. Maybe next time.
Sure.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well.
Yeah. Very good.
I really hope that, like Alex here, a lot of other people out there have seen the value of sort of talking art in a way that's comprehensive. You know, you can still go into a lot of detail just as long as you take the time to explain it at the user level. And, you know, no one really needs to know that the fancy word for a 3D relief that you are seeing is stucco. Long as you know that what you're seeing is that, and that's a specific technique. You know, you just need someone to sort of bring it down to your I don't want to say colloquial, but I guess colloquial works level for you to understand. Yeah. And once you sort of get out of the technicalities and the technicisms and whatnot, I think art is a lot more enjoyable and also a lot more user-friendly because it's very relatable. You know, at the end of the day, we're visual creatures, we're tactile creatures, we learn through our eyes and through our senses. So you may not want to pick up a history book and learn everything about Augustus, but you may decide that spending a few minutes in front of the Arapakis or whatever other piece of art actually helps you understand what it was about and what Roman society was about and what Augustus was trying to do. You know, it's just another way of learning. And I think, at least in the UK, I don't know obviously how things are in the United States where you are, Annalisa, but at least in the UK, a lot of history programs don't incorporate art history. It's almost like art history is its own little thing, and you are not allowed there because it's a scary, dark place where unless you know about, you know, Michelangelo and, Monet, it's not okay. Mm-hmm. You cannot go there if you don't have that sort of great artists' knowledge and are you know, fascinated by the difference between realism and surrealism and things like that. So it's also a way that I really want to put forward. And I've been trying over the years in the blog to sort of make art a bit more interesting and accessible. But thankfully, we have people like Annalisa as well that are literally just going for it and putting it out there for you guys to have a look at. So, you know, if you have a chance, like I said, she's in YouTube, she's on Instagram, she's everywhere that you can go on your own and see and learn. And she's here too. So go explore art and have fun, because there is a lot of it. And there you go. So thank you very much, Annalisa, again, for coming on board. Thank you, James, for...
Thank you for having me.
That's right. Thank you, James, for bringing your knowledge on all these things. Don't worry, you will be able to talk about Augustus some other time. I've been promising you this for several months now. I will fulfill my promise eventually. And thank you. And thank you, Alex, for actually letting us have our little nerd discussion, which I know can be sometimes tricky when we talk about these things. So there you go. That's all that we have time for today. So thank you very much, guys, and good night.
All right. Thank you.
Good night.
Bye.